The Guardian.
Hi everybody, Max here. Don't worry, this is not an advert. Before we start the show, this year the Guardian and Observer charity appeal is dedicated to raising money for youth homelessness and poverty among asylum seekers. These charities help provide accommodation and crucial services for those without a permanent home. Please help some of Britain's most vulnerable people and donate by calling 0151 284 1126 or visiting guardian.charitiestrust.org. Plus, we're having a telethon. You can talk to some of our best journalists, including Guardian Editor-in-Chief Kath Viner, Polly Toynbee, Gary Young, Sally Hughes, and Owen Jones. You'll need to call 0203 353 4368 on the 16th of December to donate. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. I'm Max Rushton. Did you miss me? Anyway, the Premier League. 15 straight wins for Manchester City as David Silva overtakes Kevin De Bruyne as the best player in the world this week. Wins for Manchester United, Chelsea and Spurs, while Liverpool and Arsenal fire blanks. And Burnley are up to sixth after another 1-0 victory. Elsewhere, four in a row for Leicester, and get him on that plane, Wayne Rooney scores again as Everton win at Newcastle. Also today, we get very nostalgic in part three when we look back at Arsenal's 2-0 win at Liverpool with the documentary 89. That is Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Amy Lawrence, we've missed you.
Oh, that's very, very, very kind.
And genuinely, the most of all the people saying, where is X? You know, apart from obviously last week where everyone was saying, where is Ellis again? This is a bit annoying. But yes, lovely to have you. Jacob Steinberg,
hello.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
We've just established that you have a normal-sized head and it's in proportion with your body.
Good for the podcast listeners.
Yeah, excellent. If you just want to picture that, a totally in proportion Jacob Steinberg. Barry.
Hello.
I've not seen you since we won the Football Supporters Federation Podcast of the Year.
Yes, I was, don't worry, I know you weren't there, but I was... I made sure to that you got plenty of credit for the win.
I'm sure not all the listeners have heard the speech. Do you want to hear your speech?
Not especially.
Shall we? Do you guys want to hear how Barry accepted the award on behalf of all of us?
Certainly.
Okay.
What can I say? I've made a huge mistake.
This is awkward. On a night when the stench of treachery is thick in the air. Seems rather fitting we're here in the shadow of Traitor's Gate. With me picking up this award and being interviewed by my former, what would you call yourself?
Colleague,
presenter. This isn't awkward at all, but it is quite funny. We obviously had some turmoil earlier this year. You deserve exactly half of this for your contribution until Yoko Ono McIntosh stuck his oar in and rent us asunder.
Right.
But we you know, you've moved on, you're doing well. We've moved on, we're doing okay. I'd like to thank you for your sterling contribution, producer Ben. This is our new producer, Jonathan. This is Jonathan Wilson, who needs no introduction. Producer Melissa, who can't be here tonight. And all the guests we've had over the year, many of whom are in the room tonight. So thank you, everyone.
Okay. Thank you.
So that's really nice. So we just clarify that you thanked Jimbo.
Yes.
Yeah. Producer Ben.
Correct.
Yeah. Producer Jonathan.
Yes.
Producer Mel.
Yes.
Jonathan Wilson, who stood next to you.
Mm-hmm.
All the contributors.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Many of whom were in the room that night.
Okay. Is there anyone else you thought could merited maybe just a slightest mention?
Not really.
Okay, fair enough. Swansea 0, Manchester City 4. So a new outright record of 15 consecutive wins, overtaking Arsenal's 14-game run between February and August 2002. Do you want some? I've got some lists if you want some context. Winning runs in the top four tiers of English football, that Arsenal won in 2002. 14 as well, 1905 for Bristol City and Manchester United. 14 for Preston as well in 1951 and Preston in 1892, 13. Sunderland as well, 1892. 1960 Spurs and 2016 Chelsea, 13. Most points in the top flight, they've got 49 points after 17 games. Spurs in 60-61 got 46 and Chelsea
You're
in 05-06.
Numbers.
Yeah? What do you think? Is that why you didn't thank me?
Yes.
Okay,
too
then.
Too much numbers.
I just wanted to give it some perspective. You can start off, Barry. Amy, how impressed should we be with Manchester City currently?
I just think the most important thing to say at this point is on behalf of everyone associated with Football Weekly. Thanks, Max.
That's okay.
No, I mean, it's difficult measuring how brilliant someone is while it's happening right in front of you sometimes. And we do try and lean on all these statistics and bits of video and so on to draw comparisons. They're obviously totally brilliant right now, Man City. And that kind of record is, I think, makes some of us who had curiosity about how well Pep would do when he first arrived with Manchester City. It just makes everyone feel quite daft for perhaps questioning a bit early whether the marriage would work as successfully as it seems to be at the moment. I think it's quite interesting to look at it maybe in terms of throwing it forward slightly. Are we entering an era of Man City dominance? I mean, at the moment, they look so far ahead of everybody. You can't really see not just anybody winning the league now, but if they can keep this squad together and the mojo they've got going, they really have a chance to be a fantastic team for quite a long time to come. And when you look at the Premier League lately, there hasn't really been a massively dominant team over a period of years. For the last few years, it's been shared around a bit. City have won a couple of titles a while ago. Chelsea have won a couple of titles. Man United have won a couple of titles. Leicester. If you go back a bit, in between Arsenal's Invincibles of 2004 and when Man City got their first title, it was a period of sort of shared dominance between Man United and Chelsea, where between them, they won the league more or less half each over 7 years. It was, and most of the time, if it wasn't them winning it, they were runner-up. But you just look at City at the moment, and they just have that, I don't know, they look a bit otherworldly compared to everybody else. They just look a plane above. So I think it just has a knock-on effect in the Premier League generally, because you think for other teams, there's almost a psychological thing where you think, well, okay, maybe you don't have that extra bit to come back from difficult positions or win games that aren't going your way or what have you, because it looks like City have already kind of wrapped it up.
I think what needs to be acknowledged as well is that the structure that they've put in place and that they've got themselves ready for Pep turning up. So he already had the two guys from Barcelona who were there getting things ready for probably the best manager in the world at the moment and is going to go down as one of the best managers of all time. They were buying players who were going to suit the way that he wanted to play before he arrived. They bought Kevin De Bruyne. You'd imagine that he had some kind of nudge in that direction, because otherwise you'd think maybe he would have turned up at Bayern where Pep was at the time. And he's turned him into, again, other than maybe some of the players who are at Manchester City and Eden Hazard, the most effective player in the league. But what they have over the other teams that they're competing with, and I think particularly Manchester United, is an idea of what's going on off the pitch. And when you do that with the level of resources that they have, it makes them virtually impossible to stop. If you look at Manchester United, I'm not sure how much overall planning goes into what they're doing. They've got loads and loads of money. I don't think they necessarily can't compete with City on a financial level, but I think they're just throwing a lot of money at the wall and hoping that just bringing in loads and loads of top players every single season is going to make them be able to compete. But you see with City, it's not enough. City have ideas, and I'm not sure that Manchester United do. And I think that's above all what makes City now so terrifying, basically.
Oh, we don't like people running away with it, but no one seems to be bored of Manchester City doing this, Baz.
I think them running away with it is a good thing. You know, they're kind of like the bride in Kill Bill, taking on all comers, you know, old Renishi's Yakuza army coming at her one by one.
She got a samurai
sword. Hacking them down. You know, Chelsea came at them, they beat them. Liverpool were next, they hammered them. Arsenal, they beat them well. They've just beaten Manchester United more convincingly than the scoreline suggests. And them running away with things is going to give everyone else just a good boot up the arse. And and say, crikey, you know, we have to do something about this. Like, if Manchester United are the best of what the rest have to offer, the rest are in serious trouble, because we saw how pathetic United were against Manchester City. And, you know, they only lost 2-1, but they got a hiding in that game.
So Spurs go to the Etihad next. They beat Brighton 2-0.
Next up. And so, one suspects they'll be left. Their corpse will be twitching.
So what do you do if you're Pochettino? Amy, what do you? How do you approach this game? How do you? Because Tottenham aren't a park the bus side. That doesn't seem to work anyway. Although I suppose Huddersfield gave them a go when they did that, didn't they? Because they put the ball in one half. But you can't see Pochettino doing that.
I just think what's difficult sometimes for anyone in Tottenham's position in this particular weekend, or whoever it is that's about to play Man City, is that sometimes you're just playing against a team who don't almost care about the opposition, because they get onto that level. And it's a psychological level as well as a technical and footballing level that they're on. Sometimes when you get a great team like that, they just look at each other and it's like in their eye-to-eye contact before a game, lining up in the tunnel, they know. And then you see the opposition standing up, lining up next to them, looking over at this bunch of players who have this charisma, because they just feel amazing. And when they're playing football, they feel brilliant and they feel like they can beat everybody. And that's quite a powerful thing. And I think Man City just have that in the moment. And although you know, we're all intrigued to see if somebody is going to be able to peg them back a bit, at right now, on the form they're in, you feel like it's going to take something unusual for them to not get the results that they feel that they're going to get every week.
I give Tottenham a chance. I think it's a, you know, quite a good rivalry, because Pep and Pochettino don't really like each other, and that goes back to when they were working in the same city in Spain, when Guardiola was at Barcelona and Pochettino in his first job at Espanyol, and he was actually Pep found him kind of difficult at times. The pressing that Pochettino likes to implement, and I do give Tottenham a chance on Saturday of probably doing better than some of those other teams, top teams that they've faced so far have fared against City. I think they will attempt to take the game to them, and they have players who can take on that Manchester City defence, which with Otamendi and Mangala back there and Delph at left back, it can be exploited at times. And I think that obviously with Harry Kane and Christian Eriksen in the form they've shown this season, that there probably is a chance that Tottenham can cause some kind of damage. And I think Tottenham as well have shown that they're not going to be overawed. They've gone to the Bernabeu and they've drawn. They've beaten Real Madrid at Wembley, and I know that Dortmund have had a few problems this season, but they've done similar to them.
But they also have a not very impressive record away from home against big teams in the Premier League that goes back quite a while. So they have their own kind of thing to get over from that point of view.
And that's the really disappointing thing with Tottenham, is that they haven't really, under Pochettino, apart from Manchester City 2 years ago when it was Pellegrini, won at a big away game. And also they haven't really performed as well. So I'll take back what I said about giving them a chance. I still think they've got the mentality, if they, as they showed at the Bernabeu, if they play their game, to turn this into a proper game.
Nice that Lamela came back for Spurs today. He's a lovely footballer. Interesting that Dele Alli was left out, as opposed to a few weeks ago it would have been Son who would have been left out. Shins has just sent us a tweet, Barry, saying who has more fun playing football, and then has sent a picture of Heung-min Son smiling and a picture of Shinji Okazaki, the happiest footballer in the world.
I was doing the clock watch tonight, and I think Okazaki scored first, then Son, then Okazaki scored again, but I was imagining you know, beaming at the collective beam on their chops.
I'm so happy. I just love Okazaki so much. So Spurs beat Brighton. They host Burnley at the weekend. Spurs are up to fourth, mainly because Liverpool and Arsenal both failed to win. West Ham 0, Arsenal 0 was on the telly. They picked the right one. Jacob, how impressed are you with David Moyes? Is it too much to say they look like a different team? They do a bit.
They do look like a different team. And what's interesting is that we all saw the stats about the fitness under Slaven Bilic, which was woefully overlooked under him. They had the second lowest. They were second lowest in terms of distance. I think they'd done the least sprints or something as well. And in the league, and they were so slow, and their pre-season wasn't good enough, and the players felt they weren't getting enough instructions in training, they weren't getting enough tactical instructions, they didn't know what they were doing, basically. And that, and what you see is ultimately a team that just gets hammered every week, which, and David Moyes has come in and he's making them harder to beat, and he has them looking a lot fitter and more disciplined and more organised.
It's amazing he can do that in such a short amount of time. You look at Arnautovic, right, who, even that show I did with Chris Akabusi, and you know, the positive Chris was very down on Arnautovic, but Arnautovic is, can anyone, I mean, can we all get that much fitter in 4 weeks? Has it been that long, or has it been longer?
Well, it was beginning of November, so
Really.
He hasn't had a lot of time with
I think, say, in my current vegetative state,
how long would it take?
I could do a lot in 4 weeks, okay. But I'm assuming Marko Arnautovic is already like pretty fit when Moyes took over.
Yeah, they have a top, quite a high level of fitness.
Was he fitter than you, Barry, 4 weeks ago?
Yes.
Okay.
But they are looking a lot, I think, the top sprints and everything that they've put in this season have basically all come under Moyes, which shown by the stats, and that's borne out in the last few weeks where they've gone to Manchester City and been very unlucky not to get a point. They held Chelsea to and didn't concede against Chelsea, and they've done the same against Arsenal, and they've done that in the space of 5 days against two top teams, and they were absolutely knackered last night, which probably explains some of the lack of a goal threat and the way they look dead on their feet. But it does give encouragement. At the same time, you kind of worry about how they might approach it in a against a team such as Stoke on Saturday, because they're certainly going to have to try and score some goals, and they've scored 3 goals in 6 games under Moyes, and he's not too impressed with the sort of the balance of his squad. And yesterday he had 4 strikers on the bench, and only one of them got on, Hernandez, who should have won it at the end. But he doesn't have the means at the moment to kind of change the midfield or change the system, I think. And that kind of says a lot about the way that West Ham conducted their transfer business in the summer.
There's something fun about goal line technology and players still trying to say it must have crossed the line. And just, you know, they sort of run around looking for somebody, some sort of official. It's like, someone, just give us a goal there.
That's Chicharito you're talking about.
Do you have anything more to say about Joe Hart not being there? And Adrian, 30 goals in 14 games they conceded under Joe Hart. With Joe Hart, Adrian's conceded 2 in 3 against City, Chelsea and Arsenal.
I think maybe, you know, I've made it clear I don't rate Joe Hart, but I think he was slightly unlucky in that the Manchester City game came up when it did, which meant he was forced to sit it out. Adrian played well, and given Hart's previous performances, there's no reason to bring him back. So that was kind of unlucky for him, because it's quite possible he wouldn't have been dropped if that City game hadn't come up when it did.
Amy, how much did you enjoy this game?
Well, I'd definitely say that watching Arsenal's become quite boring, actually, quite a lot of the time. And when you think about it, when it's almost like a full circle thing. When Arsene Wenger first came in, I saw Daniel Storey wrote a piece alluding to this. And I'd been thinking about it a little while ago, and I thought, oh yeah, you know, I must write something about this, and he actually did it, so well done him for being faster than me. But Arsenal, you know, the fans used to sing sort of boring, boring Arsenal, ironically, at the beginning of the Wenger era, because they were actually quite exciting, and the style and panache with which they tried to play football was refreshing at the time and different to what had come previously. But there's a lot of, I mean, I turned on Twitter this morning, and so somebody who I follow sort of went, oh, have we scored yet? Like, first thing this morning. And, you know, you get that feeling with watching Arsenal that there's the sideways passing, that's quite slow tempo that they seem to play with when they're playing against teams with a quite densely packed defensive idea. They just seem to be knocking against the door in a very kind of uninspiring way, or it doesn't seem like they're really looking like they're going to bash the door down. I don't know whether it's a question of, I felt like everyone was holding on to the ball so long, you know, I've got the ball, I'll have a look, is anybody on, is there a pass, and it's so slow, and for all the possession, it just, I think people have sussed out that it's not that difficult to just pack your team and actually, in front of your own box and, like the commentators and frustrate saying, them. It's not that difficult.
Yeah, sorry. Like the commentators were saying, if you pick Giroud, at some point you've got to lump it in the box, haven't you?
Yeah, I guess so. But, I mean, there's still so many individual players who have quality that were out on the pitch, but there's just something almost about the way that their approach. And I think Arsene Wenger was talking about it the other day in the press conference and saying how he felt football has evolved to be this defensive way, particularly with teams who are not aspiring perhaps to be in the top six, that now what people are trying to do is say, okay, you have all the possession, we'll pack our ranks and we'll take our chances if we can get them. But as if teams are quite happy now and setting up to be organised, a little bit like West Ham did, just not actually intending to take the game to a... And why not? Absolutely. If you think that's how you're going to get a result, and West Ham were really close to it with that Chikorita chance at the end. But it's a gamble, because if you do go a goal behind in the case of West Ham, then it's quite tricky when you've not teed up with a lot of creativity or a lot of goal scoring options yourselves. But people are being quite successful at it.
What did you think of Wenger's excuse about that they're hungover from the Manchester United game?
He's been complaining about recovery time. It's the classic sort of Europa League thing, where because you're playing on the Thursday night and the Sunday quite a lot, and you're playing against teams who maybe were playing Wednesday or Tuesday or weren't playing and are then playing on Saturdays, he's bringing it up often. But it's a bit of a lame excuse, because he's been essentially playing two different teams. So I fail to see quite how much fatigue there is for a lot of the guys who don't even travel to Bate Borisov or, you know, Red Star Belgrade or wherever it is.
They just get tired because they're such a unit. Like, the tiredness just...
Well, is it perhaps...
Tiredness by osmosis?
Yeah.
Right.
It means, you know, if you're playing a team that hasn't had to play in the Europa League, they have 4 days longer to, like, prepare for the game. You know, the staff have 4 days longer to work on tactics, drills, whatever. I don't know. I think it's a lame excuse as well, but managers tend to come out with lame excuses.
Jack Wilshere did a lovely turn, though, didn't he? Enough to get him on that plane?
Well, I mean... Jack, I think it's really staggering how long it's taken him to actually get a Premier League start. Given that Arsenal have not been outstanding this season, sitting seventh place at the moment, lost, I know, 6 or 7 matches in the league. He is still their most skillful midfield player in terms of central midfield. He's got the most vision. Everybody knows his fitness issues, but he's basically been as fit as he's been for a while since he's come back from this leg break. And it's taken him until yesterday to get a Premier League start. And he's been incredibly patient. I think it's quite hard to justify playing a quite imbalanced midfield, which Wenger tends to pick with Xhaka and Ramsey, because Ramsey likes to play as a centre forward and Xhaka's quite sluggish in terms of his turn of pace. So I think Jack deserves to be starting the important games and see where he goes from there. But if he keeps it up, how many better midfield players are there, central midfield players in England? On form.
I think my abiding memory of the Iceland defeat was Jack Wilshere on his knees at the end with his shirt up over his face, hiding his shame. So yeah, get him on the plane. He's such a success last time
around.
Sounds
like you enjoyed that. Hey, Jacob, you interviewed David Sullivan recently. That's always quite fun in my experience.
Have you interviewed him?
Yeah.
Right.
Did you have a nice time?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you probably asked him some more sort of pertinent questions.
Why? What do you... talk
I was
about.
Just trying to have fun, really.
Okay,
but I did. But he is fun. He is fun. I did say, where do you hate going? You know, as a chairman, because you have to go to all the games, which I find a bit annoying. And most chairmen sort of would bat that away. And he went, "Oh, I hate going to Hull and I hate going to Man City." You know, because he doesn't understand. They make me park miles away, and they don't let the kids in the dressing room or the boardroom. And I thought,
right, well,
I thought it was just quite fun to get. He's quite honest, at least.
He is very honest. I think that he said himself that he's too honest, and he probably doesn't. He's kind of the person who something pops into his head, and then 2 seconds later, it's out of his mouth, and then the next day, it's in the paper, and 2 days later, his players are saying, "Why did you say that?" And you know, you can't really control him. He's going to say it. He can do what he wants. It's his club, his money. And so he can, he's there and that's it really. And unless he says he's going to do what some of the improvements he's going to make in terms of maybe a director of football, otherwise he's just going to have to get on with it. And this is how West Ham are going to be forever until potentially his kids take over.
Does he go in the dressing room and stuff?
No, he's never at the training ground. Which, you know, if you believe some people, he's the director of football, and if you believe him, he's not the director of football. If you believe West Ham's accounts published last year, according to Karen Brady, the club's vice chair, he is the director of football. So you would think that maybe a director of football would be at the training ground, but I stress he says that he isn't performing that role, but he's never there. So he does give his managers some kind, you know, he gives them support in a certain way, and I don't think it always comes through in transfer funds every single summer or the level of backing they necessarily need, but they are left to work with their team and to pick the team that they want to have and everything. And he's interesting. I think that there are times when he certainly undermines people with some of his comments, but he's not kind of barging in there, and you know, he's not Roman Abramovich turning up at the training ground to send out a message to everybody. But I don't know whether maybe he should be doing that a bit more. If he is, which he says he isn't, the director of football.
But his heart's in the right place, Jacob.
I think his heart is... everybody says that he's a West Ham fanatic. So, you know, you could say that his heart's in the right place. Other people would say that he's in it to make money, and that he's just waiting to... And him and Gold are just waiting to sell the club, and that they have certain amounts of self-interest in terms of the way certain... loans are set up and everything. But one thing you can say about him is that he does kind of know something about football, and he is football mad, and he sort of does know a lot. But then listeners might argue otherwise, but so do we can also remember a lot of things that have happened in football. Doesn't mean that we should be running a football club or running the strategy.
Do you like to run a football club?
It would depend which football club it is.
Sunderland?
No.
Why not?
I suppose I couldn't do a worse job than the people running it at the moment, and it is a potential gold mine. So yeah, I could have a bash.
So what would if you were catapulted into Sunderland tomorrow?
I thought you were going to say Sheikh Barry there. Is that what you were going to say?
Okay, Sheikh Barry. What's the first five things you do as new supremo at Sunderland?
Buy myself a very nice office chair. Get my mate Liam, who's an accountant, in to look at the books and see how big a mess it is and what to do to sort it out. Go and introduce myself to all the staff at the training ground, and then frantically try to remember all their names and fail dismally. And then go and have a nice lunch. Is that five things?
Sounds good enough to me.
It's a start.
And you've passed the fit and proper persons test easily.
I think so, yeah.
What are the requirements of the chair, though? This is the first thing that you
Baz's chair is a
chose.
Big thing.
Well, if I was, like, say, buying a new house or moving house, the first thing I would do is telly, chair, and then you work bed, and then you work around that.
Not sofa.
Well, I'd have a chair.
Okay, fine. Next up for Arsenal, they're home to Newcastle. West Ham go to Stoke. Amy, you've been very heavily involved with 89, documentary about Arsenal, Liverpool, and we will do the whole of part three on that. So let's talk about Liverpool now. 0-0 against West Brom. Liverpool, Arsenal, Spurs, all closer in points to the relegation zone than for City. They had their chances, though, Liverpool, didn't they? And Firmino, Salah, Mane all did. Solanke had one disallowed, which I thought, Jacob, was pretty harsh. Or not? I don't know the rules of handball. I think I do, and then I forget.
It probably wasn't deliberate. but I think West Brom would have been pretty annoyed if it had stood.
He could easily have got his hand out of the way, put it that way. But I thought it was harsh that he got booked. But yeah, it was kind of one in the eye, that game, for all those who were very sniffy about Jurgen Klopp's team selection at the weekend. So he picked all four members of his Fab Four, and they didn't have a shot on target in the first half and couldn't manage a goal. So, you know, I still think it was a bit churlish to criticise his selection at the weekend. And yeah, they should have beaten West Brom. You know, West Brom aren't particularly good. They haven't improved under Pardew, though. They haven't scored yet, which is interesting. And Jay Rodriguez, you're...
Yeah, big fan.
Yeah, he was dropped again.
Oh, it's a shame. I am a big fan of a disallowed goal that takes a long time to be disallowed. So there's much celebration. And then, you know, in proportional amount of rage, even if it's the right or the wrong decision.
There's one in 2000, and this is on YouTube somewhere, if you can find it. It's Derby v West Ham in the 99-2000 season. And Derby have a corner or something, comes in, cross, shot, saved, and Dean Sturridge whacks in the rebound, and he runs off and he takes off his shirt, throws his shirt to the ground, and he's like showing off his muscles and everything, all the while failing to realise that the flag is up for offside, and he's standing there with his shirt off and everything. And then it's, you know, the mounting disappointment of everything. You have to put your shirt back on.
Did he get booked?
Scored. Would you have got booked back then? No, I don't know, because a lot of players used to... Like Ravinelli back then, used to be a big thing. Although he only put it over his head.
What's the rule if the goal's disallowed and you take your shirt off? They rescind. You can't rescind the yellow. I don't know.
I meant to bring this up. I think it was at the weekend. There was a game. Someone scored a goal, jumped into the crowd, and then two of his teammates jumped in after him. But only he got booked.
Arnautovic.
So yeah. They maybe were saying they were trying to retrieve him.
Well, they very clearly weren't. Yeah, it was Arnautovic against Chelsea. So he went into over the hoarding into the crowd. And it's a long way to the hoarding at West Ham.
Get a bus.
Yeah. He wouldn't have been able to do that under Bilic. He wouldn't have been fit enough to get to the hoarding. So he goes over to, I think it was Michael Antonio and someone else went in after him. And Arnautovic got booked. And, you know, it's very early, 6 minutes in to get booked. But the other two didn't. And I thought, well, either book all of them or don't book any of them.
It's the stupidest thing to go in as well. And it's so egotistical to go into the crowd when you've been booked, because you know exactly... Like they get referees come to the clubs at the start of every season and outline the rules, and they get told, and they still do it.
Yeah, but it's just because you lose your head, because it's emotional. I mean...
You can lose your head on the pitch, though.
Do you
and
think
also he had a very long time to gather his head. Yeah. How long?
Do you get sent off if you take your shirt off as you jump into the crowd, or with the ref like cobble them together in a combo?
Yeah,
booking?
I'd love to see a ref take out his yellow, do the one booking, and then go for the red. That would be.
All right, Liverpool got a Bournemouth at the weekend. West Brom host Manchester United. We'll talk about them next. Welcome back to part two. Before we get into the section of the show, time to pick our Toshiba Big Draw winner. To win an enormous telly, you have to do a stick man drawing like I do, because I don't have much to do the day after a pod is released. It's a way of publicising it again on the Twitter. Do a little stick man drawing. Barry, you've got the winning entry for this week. And can you paint pictures with words, Baz?
Well, it's a masterpiece. It's a riff on the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club album cover. Sgt. Pep's King's Place Pod Gang. And the attention to detail is magnificent. Everyone's in here. We've got the Carabao box. We've got a list of proper football men. We've got an AC Jimbo. An upside-down, inverted Jonathan Wilson book pyramid. A perfect podcast length timer. We'll get this up on the blog under the podcast on the Guardian website, and I'll tweet it out later. But yeah, it's very good. So congratulations to Piers William, and enjoy your new telly.
Well done, Piers. Did he say how long the perfect length of a pod should be on that?
No, apparently some egg-headed boffins in lab coats with clipboards once decided ages ago that it was 40 minutes.
Oh dear.
And then people's attention starts to wander, so we've lost them already.
Manchester United 1, Bournemouth 0. Amy, you fell asleep during this, the highlights of this bit.
Yeah, I'm afraid this is one of the tragic consequences of middle age, where I can't seem to watch an entire match of the day when it's on live from start to finish without zoning out at some point and waking up during a completely different game. So, guys, enlighten me.
I can tell you, you missed a stirring Bournemouth comeback. They should have scored. They could conceivably have beaten United, who... It was a very bang-average United performance, I think. Bournemouth were hard done by. They did very well.
What did you make of Lukaku's grumpy celebration? Didn't even celebrate, just... He almost scored and then was even more miserable than just before he scored.
I think he's in danger of, you know, the way they say sometimes dogs look like their owners. Well, maybe Lukaku is starting to resemble his manager, and I'd hate for that to happen because he's always seemed quite a cheery bloke. But I suppose he's had a lot of stuff to deal with of late, and yeah, just... You know, I don't know what was going on in his head.
Excellent open goal miss from Martial and a ridiculous strike from Rashford that hit the angle of post and bar. He caught that beautifully. On the subject of match of the day and falling asleep, my friend Ollie's dad, Tony, always for match of the day gets half a kilo of mature cheddar cheese and sits and basically and a glass of red wine and just eats his way through the cheese. And when it's done, he just falls asleep. Or whatever time that may be during Match of the Day, that's as far as he gets.
Does he do it for Match of the Day 2 as well? So.
I'm not sure what... I don't know what his tactics are for the Sunday version.
I'd like to know some tactics for avoiding the falling asleep little mini comas during Match of the Day. If any listeners have any top tips for how to stay awake...
A big mound of cocaine.
I don't think half a kilo of Cathedral City is the best way to stay awake. Southampton won Leicester 4. Fourth win in a row for Leicester. And was anybody here anything more than indifferent when Claude Puel got the Leicester job? Some honesty.
I wasn't, no.
You were indifferent?
Yeah, I thought it was a very meh appointment, yeah.
Amy?
I quite like Claude Puel, okay. I have to admit.
Are you rewriting history now? You know?
Marginally.
Okay, Jacob?
Yeah, pretty meh.
Okay. So he's doing really well, isn't he? What's he done that wasn't happening before? Because it's the same players seem to be quite... We all knew they were very quick on the break. Why has he managed to do the obvious when Craig Shakespeare didn't?
Oh, well, Mahrez's goal, by the way, was just stupendous yesterday, wasn't it? And your favourite, Okazaki...
For that smile.
Brought a smile to your own face,
really,
eh, Max? No, they just all look revived, don't they? I mean, whether it's just new manager syndrome, whether it's Claude Puel or whether it's someone else, and they just needed a new voice and some new motivating, I don't know. But they do look revived, don't they? They look like they're kind of eager again.
And a reality check for Southampton, who I thought had started to look quite good. I thought they should have beaten Arsenal the other day, but they've only got 4 wins, 6 draws, 7 defeats. Southampton go to Chelsea, Leicester host Palace. We'll get onto them in a bit. The other game last night was Everton's 1-0 win at Newcastle. Alphabetically, this was the first game last night, as an N. I thought it was quite late in the alphabet for the first game. Newcastle hit the post either side of Everton's goal. Big mistake by Carl Darlow. Wayne Rooney, right place, right time. Barry, how would you review Rooney at Everton? He's been better than I thought he would be.
He's been better, yeah. Well, I remember we were raving about him at the start of the season, saying how lean and fit he looked, and he was reinvigorated, and no doubt he was. And then there was a bit of a slump, and now he's back motoring again. I suppose his numbers are good. Is that 10 goals this season in all competitions, I think?
Is it 9?
I think we said 9.
9, but okay. It's more than Lukaku in the league.
Yeah, so...
That's why he's got such a sad face.
Nine goals in a team that, until quite recently, wasn't very good is good. But yeah, I wouldn't say he's setting the world on fire either. Just by appointing Big Sam, they suddenly seem to have gone like 9 places up the table in a matter of minutes.
They could still get that 7th.
I think they will.
He cancelled the Christmas party Do you want to hear his quotes? The party's off until there's a period of time when we're in a very good position and I can tell the lads they can have the relaxing time that they deserve. But whatever they do, I don't want a phone call telling me they've been in trouble or they'll be in even more trouble with me.
He just can't wait until they lose the FA Cup game at Liverpool, and that just gives him an excuse to go to Dubai in February with them. That's what it'll be. Warm weather training.
Yeah.
That's all those teams who complain about not having a winter break lose in the third round of the cup, get 2 weeks off to Dubai, and that's what Big Sam will do.
But literally, the Newcastle fans always complain about the fact that Newcastle never go for any cup, because otherwise, you know, what's the point of existing if you're one of those sides that aren't going to win the league? And they're in a bit of trouble now, and we've talked about Rafa.
But they're in a lot of trouble because they've lost 7 out of the last 8, 1 point out of 24. Again, looks like this takeover might happen. So I'd say that's what Newcastle fans are clinging to.
That's what Rafa's clinging to.
He'll get a war chest.
Yeah. I mean, the team's not good enough, is it? And I was at when they lost to Chelsea 2 weekends ago, and he was just very, very frustrated afterwards. Didn't really give much away in his answers and everything beyond just letting it be known that he's not happy with how things are going, because they aren't terrible, because they have Rafa and they can cause problems for teams at times, but there's just not enough quality there, and if you don't have that, then you can be very lucky to stay up.
Andy Follows asks, with Moyes and Big Sam pulling up trees at their new clubs, is it time we ask why old British managers don't get enough of a chance? Burnley are sixth. They were in the top four for 24 hours. 89th minute winner. Adam Hurry, who is at Football Cliches, who's very good if you don't follow him. Burnley 1, Stoke 0, Barnes 89, going down as the grittiest Premier League score update of the season so far. Mark Hughes after the match was a bit sad. Don't tell me that anyone says Burnley deserved to win that, because they didn't. Burnley hopes something will drop for them and they're making a habit of it.
They've won a few games like that this season and it's been 1-0. And I think off the top of my head, I think they've scored 16 goals in roughly the same amount of games. So they're not the most exciting of teams. And I don't know if people who don't support Burnley would necessarily rush to watch them play. I'm not sure how long you can keep that kind of those kind of wins going before something starts to go against you and you kind of start dropping down the league. It's interesting though that now he's being spoken about in all those big kind of, well, sort of 7th, 8th place kind of teams like Everton and Leicester were, why didn't they go for him? Why did they go for Puel and Allardyce and everything? And suddenly everyone's forgotten about Eddie Howe, who's the progressive, free-flowing guy, you know, young guy who was focusing so much on bringing through young players and young British players and playing a really nice style of football, and Bournemouth are kind of down in the bottom half and a bit worried about potentially getting dragged into a relegation battle, and everybody's kind of no one's really kind of talking about Eddie Howe anymore, and it's Sean Dyche, the kind of no-nonsense direct and guy who's being talked up for these jobs.
Do you think in 20 or 30 years time, sort of future podders will be sitting around talking about Sean Dyche the way, you know, we talk about an Allardyce or Pulis, or, you know, those proper football men?
Well, I think Dyche will look exactly the same. Mm. And I think, I wonder how he will age, because he looks so young. Age will, at one point, Howe will wake up and look old, won't he? If Wenger left tomorrow and you had to choose Dyche or Howe, who would you choose, Amy?
Oh, what a question. I need some thinking time for that.
You can have thinking time.
Well, while you're thinking, Paul Robinson was on Bein Sports the other night as a pundit.
Goalkeeper or Birmingham left-back?
Oh, sorry, goalkeeper. Mm. And I think he spent last season at Burnley, didn't he?
Yes, that's correct.
And he was very good as a pundit, very eloquent and well-spoken and informative, but he was given an insight into life at, you know, behind the scenes at Turf Moor, and how Dyche manages to have great camaraderie with his players while still being a real disciplinarian, and, you know, talking about, you know, if everyone has, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Heartbreak Ridge, where Clint Eastwood is the drill instructor, everyone if his platoon aren't wearing the same T-shirts, the same in the morning run, then they're not allowed to wear T-shirts and all this. And anyway, similar kind of thing at Turf Moor. And then they have this punishment system and players constantly grassing each other up then for infractions, like someone's not wearing the right socks.
Is this in Burnley or in the film still?
This is in Burnley.
Okay, right.
And they, every Friday then they have a team meeting and they have a wheel of fortune with, you know, from which various punishments are decided, you know, so someone might have to dress up as Elvis, do a song. There's a boy band punishment, so someone has to spin the wheel to pick three members who become part of their boy band and do a number.
So hang on, you've got one wheel with the forfeits and one wheel with the whole squad.
I can't remember the exact details.
I love this.
But yeah, it sounded like a great fun, but also a really good way of instilling discipline without being a real asshole about it.
Palace 2, Watford 1. Oh, Jacob, I mean, ridiculous game. Last 3 minutes, the whole thing changed around, but massive win for Roy there.
Yeah, well, they've done that twice in the last few weeks. They beat Stoke in, well, they were behind. Yeah, they were behind in that game as well against Stoke at home, and they came back not in exactly the same kind of fashion. The equaliser was much earlier than it was against Watford, and I think they pretty much got played off the park for probably in the first half by Watford, who are very good but kind of a bit inconsistent, and you feel they should be a bit higher than they are, mid-table at the moment after those two defeats on the road. But then sending off with Tom Cleverley changed it, and Palace, you know, you might have thought there'd be a bit of a knock-on from that Benteke miss, but instead the spirit in that side is very strong. And you know, they have had a bit of a terrible time at Selhurst Park this season, but when it gets going, and they get going, they're very difficult there. And he keeps, they've nicked a few points now late on, and that could make the difference for them this season. It's kept them above West Ham, level with West Brom, and you think where they were when he took over. He's done an amazing job so far.
Fine in the Premier League, Huddersfield 1, Chelsea 3. Decent recovery for Chelsea after that defeat at West Ham. Morata was injured. Conte played with Hazard as a sort of as a centre forward, really, which means Batshuayi should be disappointed, Baz, and should probably go somewhere else, do you think?
Probably, yeah. Huddersfield started that game well and defended really well. They were very compact, let Alonso and who's on the other wing? Oh, Moses. Just sending cross after cross after cross, and relied on their height to be able to defend, and it worked for 20 minutes. Then they conceded a goal, and that was it. Just Chelsea could have won by any number of goals. Huddersfield are a strange team. When they're good, they're excellent, and when they're bad, they're absolutely dire. You know, that performance against Chelsea was atrocious.
17-year-old Ethan Ampadu made his debut for Chelsea, replacing Andreas Christensen with 10 minutes to go. Attempted passes 19, completed passes 19. So hang on.
He has great hair as well.
Yeah, excellent hair. It's almost like he's not lived long enough to grow hair that long. Yeah.
He looks like, you know, he should be selling lentil stew at Glastonbury rather than...
I'm really pleased to see him getting a chance, though. I've heard a lot of good things about him, and like a lot of youngsters coming through at Chelsea, there's always that question about actually getting playing time. And I think that Conte has decided from what he's seen of him around the training ground that he's really worthy of trying to promote and trying to use. And I think if he's given game time, he's got a lot of exciting qualities.
He also nearly scored an own goal and fluffed a clearance just to rain on his parade.
I wasn't watching that bit. I'd fallen asleep. That was when my sleep time happened.
Funnily enough, when he came on, the first thing that was said was, oh, he's got two caps for Wales, but he's still eligible for England. As if, you know, there's still time, Ethan.
Get him on that plane.
There's every chance that he has no interest whatsoever in playing for England.
Everybody wants to play for England if they can.
I don't like that tacit implication that just because you're qualified for England, you will automatically want to play for them.
Now, Ethan Ampadu was minus 11.5 when that amazing game when Arsenal beat Liverpool 2-0. And we'll talk about your documentary in just a bit, Amy. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Amy, let's talk about the documentary 89 about Arsenal's last-minute title win against Liverpool. I mean, we all know the story. How? What was your involvement with it?
Ridiculously, I was producer, which if you ask me what that quite means yet, you know.
Does that mean you put in the money?
No, God, no. Far from it. I'd like to say I was probably kind of, I tried to be glue, basically, just pull lots of things together and be a bit involved in all sorts of things.
The Makaleli role.
Yeah, I'll take that. It was an incredible thing because obviously I've never produced a film before, so I didn't really know what I was doing. It was kind of being like thrown into a team and hoping that you don't sink. And I was lucky to have really fantastic people who did know how to make films around me and was able to try and just use some of the things that I could try and bring to the party in terms of the football stuff and the people that I knew that had been involved at the time and the writing side. And I ended up doing the interviews of the people that we spoke to. And we had an amazing time trying to put together this nostalgia fest, really, of people of kind of our sort of age. It was brilliant to spend about 18 months pretending that I lived in the 80s again. You know, it really was. It was much better than today, for sure. I just spent all my time listening to music from the 80s, and I would say I was dressing and had my hair cut like the 80s, but I didn't want to quite go that far. It wasn't that sort of method acting involved, thankfully, because my hair back then was... I actually had it shaved.
Oh, we had an undercut?
Yep, I had an undercut.
Oh, magical.
And it was quite long on the top. I seem to remember that the fashion of the time sort of rolled up jeans, Dr. Martens. Mm. It was really bad. But anyway, it was such a great story, and being when it was in that period of time, it was a really interesting period for football. I mean, in many ways, I think it was just before modern football as we know it sort of really kicked in, and the proximity with the Hillsborough disaster in terms of, you know, I think it's really very. I find it very sort of meaningful that the two most important events that I think I've ever seen in football happen within about 5 or 6 weeks of each other. The worst thing ever being Hillsborough, and then a few weeks later, probably the most dramatic game I have ever been in a stadium to see when Arsenal won the league against all odds in the last seconds, really, in stoppage time. They were very momentous football things, and they happened at, you know, when things happen at a certain time of your life, and it means, you know, more because you're 17 and you think you know everything, but you obviously don't know much about life at all. But it all felt really massively momentous. So being able to take part in something where we were able to go back over that period of time and look at it in quite a lot of depth was amazing. Now, the great thing was we found a lot of footage just in terms of the match. I mean, when, you know, we're all quite used to watching games now in, you know, high definition, and you talked earlier about hearing the screams of the players and the way we experience football, and the way you experienced it in the 80s obviously was significantly different. And we found a camera that ran through the whole of this match, and it wasn't used much during the actual TV production on the night, where they had a camera that ran right next to the dugouts, and it's kind of at pitch level, and there's lots of angles through sort of people's legs, and you're seeing thumping tackles going in and the reactions of people on the pitch, and you feel almost like it's on the pitch. It's really fantastic. And then of course being able to speak to people involved in a match where they're really interested in going over it in sort of forensic detail, and the memories a lot of these guys had are very impressive. I mean, the attention to detail, the little things that they could remember of either what they were thinking or feeling or doing, specific points during a game that happened nearly 30 years ago was actually really interesting. So being able to try and break down a kind of seminal sporting moment, give it its context, and try and take you into the moment with a bit of dramatic tension was really, I guess, what we were trying to do.
And you're blessed with the characters in that Arsenal team, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think you find anyway when people are looking back rather than when you see an interview now with a current player, for example, or even a manager, it's quite difficult for people when they're actually in the moment, quite apart from media training and so on, which obviously affects how people behave and what they feel that they can say safely and so on. When people kind of are able to sort of take off the shackles and really be candid and honest about everything that they were thinking and feeling, because they don't really care what people think nowadays, it's you get some quite deep stuff actually. So, and also some very funny stuff, because football being football, that you get that as well. So Tony Adams, for example, comes out, as you would imagine, with some interesting nuggets. The likes of Paul Merson Merson, you know, as you know, is someone who, whatever is in his head, he just says it. He's got no filter.
Often to his personal detriment. I think he gets a hard time he doesn't deserve. He's a very smart, thoughtful man. But yeah, like, he just come out with the odd bit of
nonsense. He's such a kind man as well. I mean, I've worked with him for 3 years
now.
But
he said his kind of emotional levels are like really extreme. When he thinks of something, he has quite an emotional reaction to it, like for better or for worse. And whatever that is, he just says it. It just, there's no filter at all. So, you know, he has his own, brings his own sort of personality and character to it. And Lee Dixon people, and Nigel Winterburn and Alan Smith, who, it's probably not a coincidence that they all went on to go and have careers in the media, because they're really good thinkers and talkers and analysts about what was going on. And then, you know, the big one was Michael Thomas, because it was a bit of life imitating art, imitating life, where, you know, we were putting this film together and who's the one person that we just can't quite get our hands on to interview. Michael kind of literally turned up in the film equivalent of stoppage time. So I would say we were mildly nervous about that.
Why was he reluctant to get involved?
I think that he's quite a complex guy, and he isn't someone who naturally wants to be the centre of attention. So I think there was a sense that, do I really want to do this thing that is going to make people look at me and talk about me, when he's living quite a quiet life? So he just needed a bit of time, or a lot of time, to come around to the idea. But in the end, he was fantastic. And George Graham, I mean, hearing from a manager who, of his time, he was probably ahead of his time, actually. I mean, there were certain things he did. I mean, for that game, you know, he was a classic 4-4-2 man, as were most managers in that day and age. And he suddenly threw this back three, which we're now talking about, obviously, in the modern game, into it, just ahead of what would be one of the biggest games that his team would ever play. And from being a real renowned disciplinarian who drilled his defence to death till they were kind of could recite exactly what they were supposed to do and where to be in their sleep, back four, back four, back four, back four, every single day at training, all of a sudden he goes to three at the back, and they all look at him and think, hang on, we've got to win 2-0 here at the best team in Europe, who haven't lost since January. What you know, we've got to score goals. Why are you going to what was perceived as a five at the back, you know, rather than obviously that more modern way of pushing up your fullbacks to be more like wingers and trying to create problems for? I mean, George Graham's explanation was an interesting one. He was really fixated with Liverpool's greatest, they were a fantastic team. When you look back at some of the footage of that era as well, you just remember what a magnificent side they were at that time. How brilliant, and Barnes and Beardsley and Aldridge and Rush. I mean, you know, we're talking about Man City now, or they had a really, really wonderful football team of their time as well. And anyway, George Graham specifically came up with this idea because Barnes in particular, who'd been player of the year and was amazing, he just wanted to keep him back, to push him up, and Houghton on the other side, to be putting their wingers almost out of the game by pushing your fullbacks up. So there was all that kind of stuff going on that was interesting of its era as well, because, you know, I don't even think people did that much tactical analysis in those days. I mean, even going back to how football clubs were run, there wasn't much in the way of scouting. He didn't really know what was... I mean, George Graham used to scout for players by reading the local newspapers. He didn't send people round to watch players.
Like the match ratings. He'd got, well, he got
literally,
an eight.
Literally, he used to get, amazing. He used to get on a Monday morning, his secretary used to have all the local papers from all around the country come in, and his secretary had to cut out the local journalist's column on, you know, my team. So it'd be the Stoke Sentinel or the Argus or the Pinken or the Greenan or whatever. And he would throw away all the rest of the newspapers and just read the columns on the local clubs. And if certain players kept coming up or as being highly rated, he would, you know, take note of it. And he, through reading the Stoke Sentinel local reporter, figured out that a fullback won player of the year a couple of times. A fullback winning player of the year. He's probably quite good, getting young kid, getting rave reviews. So he went to have a look at this kid, Lee Dixon, and he spotted Steve Bold at the same time. Thought, oh, big centre half, no nonsense. I quite like the look of him. And that was, you know, that was how they used to, when you compare it to watching.
It's not as good as it used to be, is it?
obviously.
Look, we're definitely going way past the, you know,
the 40-minute mark.
The 40-minute pod mark.
But where can we see this?
That's the great question.
And will our non-Arsenal fans, would it be of interest? Obviously, you're obliged to say yes, but...
Thanks, Barry. On both counts, yes, it's all the usual places you can get it on, you know, various sort of places that sell DVDs and Blu-rays or Amazon, Sky Store, downloads, that kind of stuff. You can also go and see it at the cinema if you so wish. And we've had been brilliant to have a few... We've had about 70-odd screenings through, it's called Our Screen, O-U-R, Screen, where you can either join or set up your own screening to watch it anywhere across the country. And that was brilliant because, just really quick story, took my kids and their football team to... so there's a bunch of kids watching it. And obviously, it's in the 1980s. They won't remember, obviously, anything that happened. So we were quite interested to see their reaction. And the best bit, probably, was just before... the goal, which is the famous goal, John Lukic, the goalkeeper, gets the ball passed back to him by Kevin Richardson, picks it up, and about 60 kids in the cinema went, back pass! And they just went mental because, you know, they couldn't work out that obviously
it's weird
the
that,
rules
isn't it?
Had changed.
Because you sort of think, why didn't they, apart from Barnes not just take it into the corner in the last minute, why Liverpool didn't just go, I can't remember who their centre-backs were, if it was Hanson and Beglin or whoever, Lawrence.
Nicol,
and just go pass, back, pass. Yeah. Just do that. It is such a strange rule change, that, in the whole of football. And it has totally changed the game.
It wreaked absolute havoc, didn't it?
Yeah, at the start.
Keepers couldn't deal with it.
And Merce talks about Bosnich saying the best keeper, one of the best keepers ever played with, literally couldn't kick it. I mean, just literally could not kick the ball. That finished his career. I loved all that, Amy. And
just in answer to your question very quickly, Barry, would anyone who isn't an Arsenal fan like it? I am obliged to say yes. But the thing is, if you like your 1980s nostalgia, if you're interested in a bit of old football, a fantastic story and the workings of a team, a bit of a David against Goliath kind of universal story, then hopefully you'll enjoy it.
Thanks, Amy. Let's just race through these final things because, you know, we've finished our allotted time now. Any views on the disciplinary commission going after the Football Association of Wales chief executive Jonathan Ford, who said we don't want an English manager. He should be definitely not English. We've always favoured Welsh people because arguably the passion is there. Someone said this earlier: Welsh, most definitely; foreign, possibly; definitely not English.
But it's ridiculous, just pandering to those, you know, faux outrage. And to haul them before a disciplinary panel is absolutely stupid.
Okay, good.
I would say.
In Germany, there was a full programme in midweek. Borussia Dortmund finally won, first match under Peter Sturger, 2-0 victory over Mainz. After they just got 3 points in an 8-match winless streak. Wins for 6 of the top 7. Schalke move into second at Leipzig's expense. This is more interesting from Italy. Has anyone seen the Juventus midfielder Stefano Storaro's tweet? He lost his temper on social media, directing his ire at a 12-year-old Napoli fan. He has since apologised, but here's what he said. Sit down or I'll embarrass you to such a degree that you'll cry for 3 days. Go play with your Pokemon and stop bothering me. Crow cry to your mother, you damn child. Actually, I'm at home with your mother. So he said sorry. And look, just finally, Ryan Babbel on his Twitter, because I thought we haven't mentioned Ryan Babbel, we like to do it every show. On his profile picture, it says this: call or text me direct to get in touch. +1 323 466 2109. So one pod will just have to ring Ryan Babbel and see if he answers. Barry, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jacob.
Thank you.
Cheers, Amy.
Thanks.
We'll be back on Monday. Oh, and we're doing a live show tonight. So if you're coming to that, you probably won't have heard this by now. If you listen to the pod just before you come, thanks for coming. And if you listen to this afterwards, thanks for coming. See you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.